This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this day set aside to celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., several of the organizations that vowed to continue his struggle for civil rights are in crisis or disarray or adrift. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a group co-founded by Martin Luther King, appears to be on the brink. Both the SCLC and the NAACP are in search of new leadership, and other groups no longer enjoy the influence they wielded as important players during the critical years of the struggle. In part, they may be victims of their own success. Due in no small measure to marches, boycotts, lawsuits, and self-sacrifice, the laws and policies that supported the system of legal segregation have very largely been abolished. If we still fall well short of the day when people are no longer judged by the color of their skin, there has been measurable improvement. There are still important problems that African Americans face, of course, but the world has changed. Have the traditional civil rights organizations kept pace? If you have questions about the mission, purpose, and direction of civil rights organizations, give us a call. Do these groups reflect your concerns about the future? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with a part of the largest and most important organization, the NAACP. Its Dallas, Texas branch has begun a year-long partnership with Habitat for Humanity. Members are hammering away at their first house today. President Bob Lydia joins us now by phone. Thanks very much for taking time from your project to join us.
Thank you for the invitation.
As you work on this project, I wonder, the questions of the relevance of the NAACP occur to you?
It does, but we know what we do in Dallas, what we do around the country with other branches, there's always a need for the NAACP.
And what do you see that need as?
Well, we see the need in every walk of life. We see the need in education. We see the need in housing. We see the need in law enforcement. Just wherever people are, we see a need.
In terms of law enforcement, I know the NAACP has just announced a new project to try to, bring police organizations to book.
I didn't hear you.
I say the NAACP, as I understand it, has launched a new project just in the past few days to monitor police organizations and violence.
Well, that's not new. NAACP has been monitoring police organizations for a long time. We feel like in certain instances we get the short end of the stick. And I mean, literally, we get the stick when we should not get it. And not only us, but there's a lot of other minorities that it happens to as well. So we have a need to. We can look at the racial profiling around this country, and it just didn't start in the South. It's all across this country where people of minority are racially profiled. So we need to hold someone accountable.
Now, as far as the NAACP itself goes, locally, is your organization growing?
Our organization is growing. We're doing things. We're not in the streets as much, but we are doing things. We work with the legal clinic. We work with our young people on education, on housing. We're concerned about unemployment. We're concerned about people having the right kind of health care. So we are growing.
Are your members aging? And of course, we're all aging, I'm afraid, about that. But are you getting new young members?
New young members today. We probably had 20 young people. I think we had 10 from the colleges and about 11 or 12 from the high schools that joined us to help us build this house. So we're here. Our young people are coming in force. They know the importance of NAACP. They know its history, and they know that they are here today and will take over for tomorrow.
Of course, the NAACP is very closely associated with the African-American community. What if Latinos or Muslims approach the NAACP? Could they be members? Could they be helped?
We have Latinos who's member of the NAACP. We have Muslim who we met with the last two or three years who joined the NAACP. Matter of fact, they've come to us and said that we want to know how you have sustained your organization for all these years. How did you put up with racial profiling? Because now people began to look at us and profile us. We want to learn from you.
As you look at the national organization, and obviously we'll be talking more in a few minutes about the, obviously there's a search for leadership. And do you see a search for mission, though?
The mission is always there. The leadership will change from time to time. We don't want people to stay and die in a position. Sometimes we need new blood. We need new thoughts, new ideas. But our mission always will be the same. We just need people to help us carry those out. And, people have a right to move on. And Mr. Mfume chose to move on. He's brought us a long way. We have a surplus. Our membership has grown. We've attacked some of the large issues with Adamark and some of the major chains around this country, such as Cracker Barrel. We've done a lot of good things. We have a surplus. Our membership has grown. Our branches have grown. So we've done a lot of good things under him.
As, again, you look at the organization nationally, there has been considerable friction between the leadership of the NAACP and the Bush administration. Obviously, Mr. Bush from his days as governor of Texas. Should the NAACP be working with the administration as much as it can, or should it be oppositionist?
Well, we don't want to be opposition. I think what has happened sometimes when you see things and you point it out and you call a spade, you think it's opposition. But sometimes we speak our mind and people don't like it. But I think there are a lot of good things that they've talked about that we can embrace, and then a lot of things that we're not going to embrace. And when you speak out, they think that you're always against them. But we're not against them. We have a lot of Republicans within the NAACP, a lot of Democrats, a lot of independents. So, we are nonpartisan.
Bob Lydia, thanks very much. Good luck with your continuing project. How's the house going?
It's going well. I'm going to get back down there, and we're going to have this thing covered today.
Okay. Bob Lydia, good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
Bob Lydia, president of the NAACP branch in Dallas, Texas. He joined us by phone from his office in Dallas. And let's get a caller on the line if you'd like to join our conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And Wayne joins us on the line from Kansas City.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Listen, I just wanted to say that although we've come a long way with regard to racism, however, racism is still alive and well. Organizations like the SCLC and NAACP, although there's a perception that they are struggling, they are very much needed. Blacks are still the largest minority. Blacks and Latinos are still the largest minorities in the jail populations. In various areas, schools are still segregated. In tough economic times, blacks and minorities are still the last hired, the first fired. And in conservative communities, with regard to the court systems, blacks and Latinos receive a very, very harsh, sentencing as opposed to their white counterparts. And I just want to ask the representatives of the NAACP or your guest to comment on that. Now listen offline.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Well, Wayne, before we let you go,
sure.
I did want to ask, are these organizations active in Kansas City? When was the last time you did anything with them?
Well, they are active in Kansas City. There are a number of programs that I attend. I'm not particularly active. However, when there are programs that, I find needed or that I want to attend, I do go. I do see them actively campaigning in various issues here in Kansas City.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Wayne.
Sure.
Let's talk now with Ron Walters, professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, director of the African American Leadership Institute. He joins us by phone from his home in suburban Maryland. Ron, nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be with you.
Wayne's question, in terms of the need for this organization, these kinds of organizations, the need, he says, is still there. I don't think you would dispute that. Are these organizations adapting to meet those needs?
Well, the organizations are still fighting a rearguard action because many of the gains of the 1960s and 1970s have not been fulfilled. As a matter of fact, the emergence of the conservative movement really has repressed many of those gains, and given these civil rights organizations a lot of headaches with respect to fulfilling them. So, and I think that that start, I think you can name 1980, Ronald Reagan came into office, and I think very immediately, what he did was to set about putting together an anti-civil rights program, vilified civil rights leaders, excluded them from the White House, and pretty much ever since then, it's been very difficult for civil rights leaders to gain sort of the national footing and the prestige that they had during the civil rights era. So they're dealing with that agenda that they thought they had launched successfully, and they're trying to deal sort of with the new realities and the new barriers.
Well, we've just had a new chairman of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission appointed, Gerald Reynolds, does not have experience protesting in the streets for civil rights, does not consider himself a civil rights activist. I wonder, do you see that as an illustration of how things have changed?
I do. Gerald Reynolds, of course, and I had the opportunity to talk with him the other night on a radio show, is one of those younger people who came out of the sort of a post-civil rights generation and who has been picked up by the conservative movement and placed in a position of very significant responsibility with the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Again, going back to the Ronald Reagan administration, he did the same thing. He placed someone as chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission who did not really believe in sort of the traditional notions of civil rights. Mr. Pendleton, who was the chair then, launched a tremendous battle with the members of the commission, with the Congressional Black Caucus, with civil rights leaders over that agenda. One expects that the current nominee the director will do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. We're going to, Ron, hang with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls and emails. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the traditional civil rights organizations and their future. And when we return from the break, we'll also be joined by Mark Morial, the executive of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and he'll be with us as well as we continue discussing this issue. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about traditional civil rights organizations on this day set aside to celebrate the accomplishments of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Our guest is Ron Walters, professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. And, of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller in on the conversation. This is John, who joins us from Rochester, New York.
Hi, and thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Long-time listener, first-time call.
Well, thanks very much for that.
Love your show. Mr. Walters, Bill Cosby's been in the news quite a bit lately, and I don't want my question to digress into an evaluation of Mr. Cosby's effort. But my question, I think, is a lot like the question that he posed to himself before he started expounding on the answers publicly, if you will. And that is, what is the black community doing for itself to make itself better, to enhance its image in the eyes of everyone, all of its neighbors, and to help itself as much as it can, while at the same time, very justly, seeking help and redress of grievances, which it has always done through organizations like the NAACP?
Well, that's a fair question, and I must say that one of the things that is obscured is the fact that when you look at the history of the African-American community in this country, going back now four or five centuries, we have largely been on our own. The myth, of course, that we have been sort of the ward of the government of the United States is certainly not true. If you go back to history, that's only really happened twice.
I'm sorry, the myth that you have what?
Have been a ward of the U.S. government.
I see.
If you go back historically to the 19th century, you find that after manumission from slavery, that there was a relatively brief period of Reconstruction that lasted really only into the late 1880s. Mm-hmm. That's a brief sort of 20 years. For most of the rest of that period into the 20th century, African Americans were very strongly repressed, excluded from the mainstream of American society, ghettoized. And it really wasn't until the movement of the 1960s that you had a return of government, a very brief return, of course, during Roosevelt's era, but that Roosevelt wasn't running civil rights programs. He was trying to help the nation, and blacks benefited. But it wasn't until the 60s that the U.S. government, of course, then took up the agenda of trying to make things better for blacks. That lasted another couple of decades, into the 1980s, as I said, with Ronald Reagan's coming. So you're looking at two brief periods. For most of that time, if you look at our economic progress, we're talking about a community now that has amassed somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 billion. Most of that $600 billion, obviously, is in wage income. But it is money that we have earned through the initiative, essentially, of African-American individuals and their families. If you look at education, we have closed the gap with whites in graduation rates. If you look at voting, we have closed the gap with whites in voter turnout. If you look at professional occupations, when the civil rights movement started in 1960, 7% of blacks had professional occupations. Today, that's a threefold increase. So we've done most of this by ourselves, and the government has occasionally assisted us.
Does that get your question, John?
Yes, yes, it does to a certain extent. And I know from my own education that what you said about history is true. Heinous treatment doesn't even go far enough in describing the history of blacks in this country. But for many people, they either don't know about that or it's very old news, unfortunately. People pretty much live with what they can see. And I understand the advances that you've described are true, but I think to a large extent, and again, Cosby has enunciated it well. He's high profile, so it's hard not to bring him into this. What about all the high profile things that the black, maybe I hesitate to say the black community, maybe that's not fair, but the people like the rappers come to mind. I mean, if you want to make your race or your culture look bad, then get on television and behave the way they behave. I mean, what's your thoughts on that? How do you address that? And what do you see? You've described some things that the black community has done well, but I think those things are largely difficult to know about unless you're something of a scholar. They're not highly visible. What do you see as some of the things that are really kind of low-hanging fruit that the black community could do that would be highly visible that says, hey, look it, we're here, we've made great grounds, we are good neighbors, there's, you know, let's prove people wrong. I'll give you an example. They didn't.
John, I'm not trying to cut you off, and I just wanted to bring this back into the conversation that we're talking about civil rights organizations and maybe what they, as opposed to the African-American community at large, can do. Ron Walters, did you want to get into that?
Yes. Well, I think the civil rights organizations really have two types of agendas. One, of course, is that because they are leaders of the African-American community, they have a job to do in terms of the internal workings of that community. Regularizing affairs of the community in terms of trying to bring about unity, power, programmatic change, those sorts of issues. But it also has a large responsibility to represent that community and to bring pressure, quite frankly, to bear in an aggressive way upon the political system so that, that system understands that there are still needs, so that they have this twofold agenda. To the extent that they're able to be successful, or let me just say it like this, not be successful with respect to the public agenda and bringing pressure to bear on the political system because it has rejected them over the course of the last three decades. Many people are wanting to say, well, now their main responsibility, and this is Reynolds' point, their main responsibility now is to the community. And I think that's what the caller is talking about.
Okay, John, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's bring another voice into the conversation, and this is Mark Morial, who's president of the National Urban League. Like the NAACP, the National Urban League was established at the turn of the last century. It continues its work today, and Mark Morial, a former mayor of the city of New Orleans, president of the Urban League for the last 2 years, is with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for
coming
in.
Good to be with you, and happy King Day to everyone.
We've been talking about some of the economic disparities both within the African-American community and comparison with the white community. How does the Urban League try to address these disparities? How does the Urban League try to make itself continue to be relevant?
We do our work perhaps. We have a unique status as a civil rights organization because we are a direct service provider. So through our 104 affiliates, We serve each and every year approximately 2 million people. The vast majority of them are African American, although increasingly as communities change, we're also serving people of color. And what do I mean by serve them? We run and we operate early childhood centers, including Head Start centers around the country, where we serve over 300,000 youth. We are the largest provider of after-school programs to African-American youth in the country after government, mm-hmm. where we serve another 350,000 people. We're also a significant nonprofit job training organization. We do things in the economic arena that very few people do. We work one-on-one to connect people with jobs, and we did that for 25,000 people. We run first-time home buyer programs, financial literacy programs, computer training programs, and a wide variety of very important programs. So we do that. In addition to that, and that's one prong of what we do, we're also an organization that does a fair amount of public policy and other research. We publish every year the State of Black America report. On a quarterly basis, we publish a jobs report, and we do a wide variety of things. Thirdly, we work in the public policy arena, and we work to advance public policy issues. We work with other civil rights groups on civil rights issues on Capitol Hill. We work with many groups on various economic issues from a public policy standpoint. The vast majority of our work takes place at the local level. I think that's the case for the NAACP too. That's the thing that the mainstream media, the press, the national media, doesn't necessarily pay attention to because they don't see that as its charge. But I think in today's world, so much of our work is now carried out at the local level.
Is your organization growing or shrinking?
Our organization is growing. We recently added a new affiliate in Las Vegas, Nevada, a growing community. The size of our organization in terms of the number of people we serve continues to grow. The size of our consolidated budgets continues to grow. But I would say that our challenge, like so many civil rights organizations and organizations who really, really led the way in the 1960s, is to connect with a new generation of Americans, a generation born perhaps in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And even the 90s, who have come to age in an America that is different than the America of the 50s and the 1960s and may not be as connected or as bound to much of the work that that Dr. King did, who see it as a point in history. And we've got to move to connect with those folks and connect with that community and connect with that generation in a new way. And I think that's our challenge, and our growth and our relevance is going to depend on our ability to connect with that new generation.
Let's get another caller on the line. Jerry joins us from Baltimore.
Yes, let me say that the reason that I think these organizations are in decline, certainly in the public perception. Now, Baltimore is the headquarters of the NAACP, and I think Kwasi Mfume left the organization because I think he sees the need for a new vision for civil rights. And that is economic. And the real problem, Neil, is that the Congress has refused to pass an increase in the minimum wage law. And most of the things these civil rights organizations are doing relate to economics because there's a total neglect, certainly by Bush and the Republicans, of this whole issue. So I just want to make a guess, and Ron Walters can confirm it or deny it if he knows. I think Mfume is going to expand to class problems because the civil rights, I think the civil rights issues are mostly economic, and it's class and not race that is that ought to be the concern of these organizations, and I'm not sure that is.
Ron Walters, we'll hear from you, and then add Mark Morial as well.
Well, let me say Happy King Day to Mark.
Hey, Doc. Good.
Organization is well served by having him as its president.
Thank you.
I think that you can't say that the problem, of course, is class and not race. It is both race and class. And if it were only class, then I think African Americans would still be discriminated against because we are a minority. Let's think, though, about that for a second. Because when you look at things like living wage, minimum wage, look at the fact that Small Business Administration has been excluded in terms of increases and strengthening, watered down because now women and white males have been allowed to get federal contracts. When you look at the banking regulations, we're not sort of living up to enforcing the community relations and the community renewal aspects of those banking regulations that serve communities. All across the board, we have had a period of history here where the federal government has not lived up to responsibility to deal with these class-based issues, and they are extremely important. So I would hope that if we could deal with those issues, then race might take a back seat. But as long as society, especially the federal government, and even the private sector, does not deal successfully with the economic issues, then race will still be out front.
Let me just interrupt to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mark Morial,
I agree. It is a combination of class and race. For many African Americans, their economic standing is tied to their race. It's tied to past exclusions, continuing exclusions that are based on race in American life. But I do believe that the unfinished work of Dr. Martin Luther King is in the economic arena. And I think the caller makes that point. It is closing the economic gap that our own research shows is quite considerable. If you compare the education gap with the health gap and the economic gap is twice as large between African Americans and whites as it is in the economic arena as it is in education or in healthcare. The other point I would make is when we talk about the economic agenda, it is living wages. It is also a greater focus on home ownership, a greater focus on entrepreneurial and business development in the African American community and in America's urban centers. It's also closely tied to continuing access by African Americans to institutions of higher education. So when you see restrictions on a Pell Grant program, for example, what that does in the short run, it's an education issue. In the long run, it's an economic issue to the extent people are unable to reach their full potential in terms of their academic achievement and their educational access. So it's no doubt that there needs to be a greater focus and a new conversation on economic issues.
Let me just ask you, some of the things you said, they'd be pretty welcome news over at the White House. Civil rights organizations are often seen, talking about entrepreneurship, ownership. These are ideas that we're going to be hearing a lot about from President Bush, we suspect, in his second inauguration. Civil rights organizations are often seen as armed to the Democratic Party. Should that continue?
I think that civil rights organizations need to be non-aligned. I think we need to have a basic mantra that we have no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, and only permanent interests. And that is the mantra of the Congressional Black Caucus, and that was the statement they made when they were founded over 30 years ago. So we should understand.
Forgive me, I think they're all Democrats.
Who's that?
The Congressional Black Caucus.
It doesn't matter what your party is. It matters what determines your agenda. And I think we're at a stage now where the reality is with the changing landscape, particularly here in Washington, that what we have to do is to define an agenda. People forget, and I just shared this, just spoke over the U.S. Conference of Mayors earlier, that it was a bipartisan coalition which passed the Civil Rights Act, which passed the Voting Rights Act, which passed the Fair Housing Act. Is it possible today for us to construct a coalition that is indeed bipartisan? I will say this, it certainly ought to be a goal. Am I naive in thinking that? Perhaps. But I do believe that the sooner both Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals realize that this nation is becoming a nation that is going to become more diverse, a nation without a majority ethnic group, and that closing the divide, that finding reconciliation by creating a climate where a level playing field is the rule and never, never the exception, then it is going to serve the best interests of the nation. And I strongly believe that. And I think on Dr. King's birthday, it is a time when we can look forward. It is a time when we can think a little bit more, perhaps in a visionary way.
Jerry, first of all, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. And Mark Morial, we know you're busy. Thanks for having part of your King Day with us. Thanks very much. We're going to continue this conversation when we return from a short break. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about the upcoming confirmation hearings for Secretary of State nominee Condoleezza Rice. She'll be facing questions from senators tomorrow. Join guest host Lynn Neary tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about the future of traditional civil rights organizations, many looking for new leadership, some involved in internal struggles. Our guest is Ron Walters, professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. And joining us now is Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, a former assistant director of the NAACP in the late 70s and 1980s. He saw firsthand how that organization was operated, and he's with us now from our studio in New York. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Neil.
What's the role of civil rights organizations today after so many years after the death of Dr. King?
Well, you have to remember Martin Luther King's agenda, and that was not what is Martin Luther King Jr.'s day has become, photo ops for politicians at black churches. The agenda of King was to stop and do the segregated landscape, to eliminate segregationist thinking. And the agenda has always been to unlearn stereotypes, to get people to fight racial discrimination, to fight racial paternalism and separatism and racial idiocy. We have to remember on King's Day of all days that there is no such thing as race. There is only one race in which we all belong, and that's the human race. So, but at the same time, civil rights organizations are living in the past. They're still trying to have racially identifiable colleges, for example, trying to maintain black colleges. We can't maintain black colleges. What we got to do is to stop this emphasis, this idiotic emphasis on racial separatism. The NAACP's opening, for example, of a presidency. It's supposed to be an inclusive organization. It says its membership is open to everyone, regardless of race and or nationality or religion. But Asians need not apply for the presidency of the NAACP. Hispanics need not apply for the presidency of the NAACP because the NAACP presidency is regarded as a black opportunity, a black job, because the NAACP, despite its heritage, despite its policies, despite its values, is alleged to be representative of the black community. That is not what the NAACP was supposed to be. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was an effort to integrate, to bring minorities, to bring the people who have been racially isolated and discriminated against, bring them into the mainstream. And in that regard, we've got to fight for integration. We've got to make sure that minorities in particular have the opportunity and the mechanisms and the means to join the mainstream. And that's what Bill Cosby was talking about, because what you have with respect to too many organizations is parochialism. They have dumbed down standards. We've got to make education the civil rights agenda of this nation so that we fight for standards. We shouldn't be fighting against standardized testing, for example, as culturally biased. Roy Wilkins, my mentor, one of my mentors, Kenneth Clark was the other. Roy Wilkins used to say to blacks, we've got to learn what the white boys learn. And we've got to be better. And therefore, we have to believe in standards. And we have to insist on standards on the part of pupils and teachers so that when people are born into poverty, born in the ghettos, do not have middle-class roots and middle-class professional parents, education is the great equalizer. We need standards. That's what Bill Cosby was saying, albeit to a group, an audience of bourgeois, black-tied, tuxedoed Negroes.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Elizabeth is with us from Miami.
Hi, Neil, and wow, what a refreshing thought that your guest has been talking about. My comment is very similar, is along the lines of what you just mentioned. I see this day as a remembrance day for struggle for equality in the face of adversity, regardless of color or race. I'm speaking as a Latina and from Arab American descent. I'm curious to hear what your guests think about, you know, today civil rights is such a foreign issue because most people, mostly from my generation, just it's not like a life and death situation where we don't see segregation, we don't see racism, yet as an Arab American, I'm curious, we're villainized. And I'd like to see more unification of all these civil rights organizations, including the Arab American organizations, working towards the common goal and not about securing their PR space or financial funding.
Mike Myers,
I think Martin Luther King would want it that way.
Michael Myers, you sort of addressed this a moment ago. I was interested to hear from Ron Walters on this.
Well, hasn't he had enough time?
Well, hear from you as well.
I have less than 4 minutes on the air. He's had at least 20 minutes.
Well,
I mean, give the other side of civil rights an opportunity to speak.
I certainly will, but I did want to hear from Ron on this. Excuse me just a second. Ron, would you go ahead, please?
Well, first of all, I would agree with the young lady about the universal aspects of civil rights and the way it ought to apply to all people. As a matter of fact, that is certainly occurring. When you look at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, for example, 20 years ago, it was known as an organization, federal organization, that really dealt with discrimination in employment for largely because of race. Today, if you ask for the statistics by race, you see something very surprising, which is to say that race discrimination complaints are still there. They constitute, in the last quarter, 30,000. But discrimination in things like age, sex, disability, these things now outweigh discrimination by race. And whites are using that agency, of course, for this purpose. So it is true that discrimination is a broad problem in American society. It's not just relegated to blacks. And certainly Martin Luther King Jr. didn't have that. But at the same time, I would say that I think it's ridiculous to talk about eliminating black colleges. They account today for 20% of all of the young African Americans and some whites who are graduated in this country. And without them, they wouldn't have an opportunity. I am a graduate of one, Fisk University, and I'm thankful for that opportunity that they gave me. That's not separatism, because they were not responsible for the fact that those institutions had to be created because we were excluded from the mainstream. Today, there are still very strong areas of exclusion, and so we need those colleges to help young people who can't.
But what about Elizabeth's question? Should the civil rights organizations make themselves more open to issues, for example, for about Arab Americans?
Well, for example, they are. One of the problems, of course, that we have dealing with this question is that a lot goes on that people are not aware of, and that they're not aware of it because the media, of course, does not project it. But if you look at what's going on here in Washington, D.C., where I've been for the last 35 years, for on most issues, you have a great deal of cooperation from the Asian American civil rights organizations, the Latin American organizations, and now many of the Arab American organizations have come in. And so that kind of cooperation has been going on for a long, long time. This isn't anything we have to create or anything that's new.
All right, Michael Myers, you'll get the last word on this.
Well, look, we're in a 21st century world. We can no longer live in the 1950s and 1960s. These civil rights organizations are reenacting the past, past marches, past glories, past history. You got to join the 21st century, whereby the majority of blacks now go to majority white institutions in higher education. But the point is that we've got to have non-racially identifiable colleges and universities. That's what the agenda was, not to have black colleges or white colleges or yellow colleges or brown colleges. Moreover, we've brought blacks to the majority campus, and we've abandoned them. We have not allowed blacks to interact with the majority because we have colleges that fund, support, instigate, arrange for separate programs for blacks, separate jobs for blacks, window dressing jobs for blacks. We can't have a vice president or a president of a college without saying a vice president for minority student affairs. This is racial paternalism. It's isolation. It is parochialism. We've got to get beyond this and fight for true economic opportunity, equal opportunity, and yes, a getting away from racialism. But at the same time, understand that blacks have been excluded because of their race. But in terms of joining the mainstream, they must be brought under to the mainstream with the insistence on standards. And that's why it's important from K through 12 to insist that students are brought up to standards, and that teachers be evaluated based on the academic achievement or the lack of the academic achievement of their students. And in that regard, it seems to me that the civil rights organizations of all the groups have got to fight against these teachers' unions who protect jobs as opposed to make sure that our children learn and learn at the highest standards. We've got to have the NSB stop fighting standardized tests as culturally biased. They're not culturally biased. They're not culturally biased for Vietnamese, for example. We've got to face the facts of life.
Michael Myers, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for the little bit of time you gave me.
Michael Myers is Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. And Ron Walters, as always, we would like to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ron Walters, Professor of Government and Politics at the University of Maryland. When we come back, a new piece of civil rights history.